The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
Talking about those retail names and how they are trading. There's a Bloomberg opinion piece today that talked about Black Friday fatigue, how it's a warning sign for retail. In the column, it was noted online sales during the crucial kickoff to the holiday season reaching, though, a record $9.1 billion. This is according to Adobe Analytics, but the 2.3% increase from last year's supply chain crunched season tepid compared with 13% in 2020 and 19% in 2019. So in-store traffic about apparently similarly insipid. So let's see what our next guest has to say about all of this, because he has tons of data that makes him an expert on holiday retail shopping. Back with us, we welcome Patrick Brown, VP of Growth Marketing and Insights over at Adobe. He's with us on the phone from Burlingame, California. So Patrick, nice to be with you again. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Nice to chat with you again, Carol.
So tell us, you were on with us in early October. Talk to us about the retail environment, how it's changed, gotten better, gotten worse since then.
Yeah, so, I mean, we've seen, the strength leading into Black Friday, you know, was really driven by the discounting. And discounting started each year, it seems to start earlier and earlier. And this year, you know, we saw consumers, or retailers rather, starting to discount as early as October when we had a Prime Day. And what we've seen is those discounts just stayed low, and they've stayed, you know, continuing through to Black Friday. And while Black Friday year-over-year perspective, you know, was only a 2.3% up year-over-year, it did exceed $9 billion online. And what's happening now through the weekend is we're seeing the demand actually online accelerate. So Saturday and Sunday, we saw the equivalent of a Black Friday in sales, $9.5 billion, which is up about 4.4% year over year. So, and then leading into Cyber Monday, where we think the strength is going to continue on to be about a 5% year over year growth. So I think as retailers continue to deeply discount and figure out where consumers are have got some demand across some categories like toys, they're leaning into the discounts and driving some growth.
You know, Patrick, when I hear the word discount, as a cheapskate, or I guess frugal shopper, some may call me,
smart shopper.
My ears perk up at discount. But are there any certain categories where you're likely to get better discounts this year? And are they all gone? Or are there still discounts available for the rest of the season?
Well, it's a great question, and I think smart shopper is the right word. I'm similar. I mean, we've seen the discount started, like I mentioned, in kind of with Prime Day in October. And then what's happened is for categories, especially around Cyber Monday, where you see electronics, like traditionally has been a really core, deeply discounted category, 27% discounts. But toys continues to kind of rule the day for Black Friday and through the weekends, where we see up to 33% discounts. But sporting goods, 20% down. Jewelry, interestingly, one of the categories that we're also seeing come up as consumers are more comfortable buying larger products online is furniture. Furniture and appliances, believe it or not. We're seeing discounts and seeing some demand where discounts are in the 10 to 15% for even those products.
Do I have to wait 12 months, 6 months to get my couch, though, if I do that?
Well, thankfully, I think, you know, last year it was all about there wasn't really very good discounting, and it was all because of supply chain. Retailers just didn't have things in their shelves or in their distribution centers to fulfill some of the demand, so they had to keep prices higher. I think in some cases, retailers are working off a bit of an inventory glut. So they are using this to manage some of their demand. They're spurring growth with lower prices, but I think you will actually get your couch, and it won't be 8 months.
Hey, one thing I want to ask you, if you have any thoughts, I mean, if this extreme discounting continues, and I think about the retailers, what that means for margins and what kind of numbers we'll see ultimately when they, in the new year, report their fourth quarter numbers. Because I was in Saks just walking through on Friday, on Black Friday, didn't buy a thing, but spend $150, you get a $75 gift card. And I'm thinking, wow, that's great for the consumer. It also guarantees you're going to come back and spend. But I mean, that's got to hurt retailers.
Well, I mean, they are managing their inventories, I think, like you're alluding to. And so they're able to kind of, you know, it's better to sell some product and drive some future growth and drive some LTV where somebody can come back and potentially, you know, be a future shopper even in the coming year. I think, interestingly, even though if you're in the store, one of the things that we're observing, or maybe it's World Cup related, mobile shopping is eclipsed 52% of the sales through Black Friday and through the weekend. So even as people have been out, they're still purchasing, maybe not in a store, but they're buying online, and they're just finding themselves, the way that they're buying is much more fluid. And so I think that retailers are driving volume and driving demand. There is consumer demand out there. I think they're leaning into it with discounting.
Right.
And I think that's likely to continue into the coming December.
Those cell phones are dangerous, I always say, you know.
It's so easy
to go
sure.
Click and buy something.
Click.
It's gotten so good, the technology, I agree.
Until your spouse is like, do you know what you just did in like the last 20 minutes? Patrick Brown, good to check in with you, and hopefully we will again over the holidays. VP of Growth Marketing and Insights over at Adobe, on the phone from California.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Nearly impossible to miss the video and pictures and stories about the protests that have erupted against China's COVID zero strategy. We were talking about it with our TV colleagues in terms of the market impact. We talked about it earlier about Apple specifically, but it does represent one of the most significant challenges to Communist Party rule since the Tiananmen crisis more than 30 years ago. So great to have a voice back with us, a member of the Bloomberg family, to be quite honest. He's back in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Andy Brown, former editorial director at Bloomberg New Economy, spent 3 decades in Asia as both China editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He leads the China Hub as a partner at Brunswick Group today, a critical issues advisory firm. So grateful that you came back to Bloomberg to talk with us, Andy, again. So the disruptions, the protests, how do you think President Xi is kind of, what's the calculus around that for him?
First of all, Carol, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me. This is historic, the events in China over the weekend. And I think it is the beginning of the end of COVID zero. And it is going to be, I fear, a messy, chaotic, and deadly unwinding of an irrational, poorly conceived and disastrously executed policy that has Xi Jinping's name all over it. He owns it. And he owns the public outrage that led to this, to these street protests and campus protests all over China over the weekend.
So a mistake by Xi?
Look, it's an indictment of Xi himself, okay, but it's also an indictment of the system that he set up. And it is a top-down, heavy-handed, personalized system, inflexible, ideological, highly politicized, at times brutal. And the system failed, and it's failed catastrophically. And, you know, the irony is that it has triggered precisely the thing that Xi Jinping most fears. So, you know, for the first
meaning
time...
Meaning protest, right?
Well, protest, but the type of protest.
Okay.
So, you know, there are protests in China occur all the time, okay? But they're almost always localized, single-issue protests. You know, workers aren't getting paid in a factory or in a rural area. You know, some government-connected business has grabbed your land. A lot of protests. But they're never networked, right? And they're very easily contained. These are nationwide protests that bring together disparate groups of people, poor people, rich people, mm-hmm. students, workers, together for a common cause, and that is to defeat COVID zero, which has led to enormous amounts of frustration within the population. And the trigger for this was a fire in Urumqi in an apartment block that mm-hmm. killed at least 10 people, including, we see the picture of this lovely Uyghur lady and her children. And the suspicion was that they had got trapped in their apartment by COVID restrictions. So fire exits being blocked or, you know, and these concrete barriers that get placed around blocks so the fire trucks couldn't get in and extinguish the blaze. And this triggered something very deep, very emotional. That lady was everybody's mother, everybody's sister, you know, everybody's wife. Those children could have been my kids because, you know, you've got 400 million people in China now living under some kind of a lockdown, many of those in precisely those conditions. You know, their front doors have been welded closed because they can't get out, and people live in fear and have been living in fear now mm-hmm. for a long time. And so, you know, this fire just triggered this swelling sort of surge of anger right across the country. And it was so big, it wasn't, you know, how clever they are and how you know, efficient they are at blocking discussion on social media. This outbreak, a burst, was just so passionate that they couldn't contain it.
I was amazed at the amount of video and pictures that we were able to all see throughout the weekend.
Yeah. Well, Andy, I wonder what the next few days look like, do you think? I mean, will there be an effort to suppress these protests, to put them down and sort of put people in jail and counterattack against the protesters? It seems like it could get ugly in the next few days.
You know, Mike, here's the reality. Xi Jinping has no good options here, okay? He only has tough decisions, difficult trade-offs. So I'm pretty sure that with every fiber of his body, he wants to crack down, okay? I mean, he is haunted by the collapse of the Soviet Union, which, you know, he blames. They lost their ideology, abandoned Stalin, repudiated Stalin, but they lost controls of the levers of power. They compromised, you know, glasnost and perestroika. He's absolutely determined that that is not going to happen in China. So he doesn't want his policy, you know, his signature policy to be derailed, to be challenged by street protests. And I'm pretty sure that they're already now, you know, going after some of these leaders of the protest. But here's the thing, the more, you know, if he cracks down violently, you know, he could provoke an even bigger social explosion. People have had enough. I mean, they're really up to here with zero COVID. Now, on the other hand, if he opens up and opens up too quickly, he risks an explosion in cases and mass death. You know, even under the most optimistic scenarios, if they opened up like Taiwan did or Singapore did, you know, because of the infectiousness of Omicron, you know, and the vulnerabilities that you have in and even a highly vaccinated society, you're still going to get, you know, a million or more deaths. Now, that's dynamite. Mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. Xi Jinping, you know, the Americans lost a million, the Europeans lost a million. This proves, you know, the decadence and incompetence and the corruption of their system, their careless system. But we in China have a superior system. You know, very few people died outside of the original outbreak. So he's got to be very, very careful. But you know, look, this, you know, the real problem here is that there has been a staggering failure. And it is the failure to build defenses against Omicron that, you know, they've been mm-hmm. so fixated on, you know, on zero COVID that they haven't invested in ICU beds, in trained specialist medical staff. But most importantly, they haven't adequately vaccinated their elderly population. You know, so and of course, they have no natural immunity now.
So how do you, like, I've been hearing a lot of commentary that this isn't another Tiananmen Square, but could it get to that point? So is that a bad comparison?
Yeah, look, we've moved on. Okay. And look, I wouldn't rule anything out, but we've moved on. The government Has far, far more sophisticated tools now to counter dissent than they ever did back then. As I say, I'm pretty sure, look, every square inch of every city in China is watched by a camera. They already know, you know, who the leaders of these protests were, voice recognition, face recognition, gait recognition. They're probably in touch now with their networks, with their professors, with their colleagues, mm-hmm. with their families. But, you know, here's the other thing. The protesters are also pretty clever, too. And they've shown a tremendous amount of ingenuity. So you see these students at Tsinghua. This is a crazy one where they're holding up a banner with a mathematical equation. I guess you need to be a mathematician, and I'm not. You need to be a mathematician to understand that this equation was written by a mathematician called Freeman. Okay, it's Freeman's equation. So it was this sort of subtle algebraic cry for liberty.
Right.
You know, blank sheets of paper and so on.
Is Xi at risk of losing some of his political clout, which he just cemented, you know, recently?
You know, his model and his governance style are now going to be open to much greater scrutiny.
On a global stage?
Well,
domestically.
Domestically, you know, I mean, here's the operating model for Xi Jinping's China, okay? And it starts with this vast institutional capacity, endless sums of money, you know, a bottomless pit of resources. Mm-hmm. It's all powered by high technology and animated by this whole of nation, you know, mass mobilization. It's an awesome machine, right? But, you know, and it's capable of great good. You know, you aim this machine at the problem of poverty and, you know, you eliminate absolute poverty. And they've done it, right? And mm-hmm. Or you aim this machine at building world-class infrastructure and you get, within a few years, like the most extensive high-speed train network in the world. But it's also capable of great harm, right? And so you aim this machine at Xinjiang and you get the horrors of, you know, internment camps and a million Uyghurs. You know, you aim this machine at COVID and you get COVID zero.
Right.
Okay. And it's the fact, but it actually shows the limitations of this operating model because it has clearly failed, you know, against COVID.
Andy, do you think if China had accepted the Western vaccines, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, would it be a whole different scenario here? Would they be able to open a lot less risky than they are now?
You know, I think people exaggerate this point. Look, it's baffling, right, why they didn't take mRNA vaccine. It's the best in class vaccine, but it's not the game changer that people say it might be. Chinese vaccines are okay. They're fine, right? They do a fine job. They prevent serious illness. They prevent death. But that's if you have your three-dose regimen, right? You get your two vaccines and your booster. The problem that they have is that they haven't insisted that their elderly get vaccinated. You know, I was in Singapore this time last year, for the Bloomberg New Economy Forum. We were part of the reopening. And they were adamant about that. They weren't going to reopen until they had, and I can't remember what it was, 80% or more of them elderly people. And they had a lot of resistance.
Right.
And they overcame that by telling the elderly, if you don't get vaccinated and you get ill, you're going to pay for your hospital treatment, right? So they put a lot of pressure on, but they focused on this.
Right.
Why China hasn't focused on this is something of a mystery.
Well, lots of mysteries, and it feels like every week there's something new coming out of China that certainly upends things, and we really appreciate you coming in to help us make sense of it. So, Andy, thank you.
Thanks, Carol. Thanks, Mike.
Always appreciate it. Andy Brown, of course, he is partner at Brunswick Group. He is a critical issues advisory firm. Andy, of course, former editorial director Bloomberg New Economy, and so much more. We really appreciate it. Andy, thank you.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So the holiday season off and running, many headed to spend time with families over this past week and weekend for perhaps the first time in 2 or 3 years because of the COVID pandemic. Great reunions, yes, we know that. But Mike, it can also be a charged time when it comes to conversations around the dinner table and more, right? We hear about stress and all that good stuff.
Absolutely. And no politics, please.
My husband always used to be like, don't, because I always used to bring up politics at dinner. All right, so our next guest can probably help all of us with that. His book, The Art of Conscious Conversations, Transforming How We Talk, Listen, and Interact. Let's get to Chuck Weisner. He is someone who has worked with leaders and their teams at Google, Ford, Tesla, Shell, General Motors, and Chrysler. He joins us on the phone on this Monday. Hey, Chuck, nice to have you here with us. Did I say your last name correctly?
It's Weisner.
Weisner. Forgive me. My bad. Chuck Weisner.
Like W-I-Z. Weisner. Yeah.
Weisner. Okay. Okay, Chuck, well, good to have you here with us. And let's talk about your book, because you have worked with a lot of companies. Tell us about your background and the work that you've done in the past.
Okay, well, I'm actually formally trained as an architect, and I changed careers because I couldn't stand the conflict, and I figured there was a better way to have conversations. And so I studied the ontology of language and did mediation training, and all of that one thing led to another, and I changed careers. And then I've been working with leaders and their teams for the last 30 years.
So, Chuck, when you talk to these executives, what are sort of their goals to improve conversation? Is it, you know, they want to have more personality, be more engaging? What are they looking to do?
Well, it varies, but I think the biggest problem is often there's a lot of miscommunication. And there's a lot of misunderstanding for leaders about how powerful their voice is. And I say that as an example, like a leader could be in a meeting and say, well, that was really a stupid idea. And they think they're just sort of bantering about. And someone could leave that meeting thinking, oh, gosh, I'm really in trouble. I might get fired tomorrow. So there's authority issues and issues of power in their voice. And then there's a lot of leaders forget to create a good story and enough context for people to really understand what they're doing. And so having a clear mission, context, and then being really, really mindful of how to create safe psychological safety so you can have robust conversations is one of the biggest things we work on.
So, Chuck, I got to say that in reading in and looking at your book and looking at your background and knowing that you worked with Tesla, I was dying to ask you, how do you think Elon Musk is doing?
Well, Elon, I think, needs to take a little breath and step back from the circus that he's involved in, because building a car or building a rocket ship is really different than what he's entering into now. It's such a different kind of way. It's such a social cultural format that every thing that he does and everything that he says, again, carries a lot of authority. A lot of people listen to him. And so I think he needs to find a little bit more courage to step back and really decide what he wants to do and speak more mindfully.
Yeah, Chuck, I wonder what you've learned about successful executives when it comes to sort of the art of conversation. Is it, you know, dominating a conversation, does that sort of correlate to success in the business world, or is there more to it than that?
I think that's the biggest downside. So leaders get to where they get to because they were expert engineers or expert tech people or whatever, and then they get elevated. And we actually are, and they are, rewarded for having the answers. But the higher you get in an organization, the less you can have all the answers for all the problems that you face, or less you can know about everything that's going on in an organization. So actually, a great book years ago called Good to Great, they were trying to figure out why companies that became great instead of good, what happened. And they didn't want to focus on the leader, but one thing that kept coming through and through and through is these leaders that were doing the great companies, they had a humility that allowed them to trust their experts, allowed them to trust their team, and to create a space where they could have really open, honest, creative, and good conversations. So humility is a better attribute than say arrogance and thinking you have all the answers.
So who's the CEO or leader could be any walk that you think is just spot on when it comes to conscious conversations?
Okay, that's a tough question. I have to be careful because all my work is so confidential. I certainly have worked with Doug Field, who was at Apple and is now at Ford, mm-hmm. Who really takes this stuff to heart. And his ability to communicate with folks, to create the excitement around the mission, and then to really allow people to bring in the best people and draw the best people and allow those folks to do great work. I think he's one example. And in the past, I'm thinking of a few, energy company that I won't name, but that I've worked with, and where that leader really transformed from not understanding sort of ideas about business culture to realizing how much culture shapes the success and the way companies do their work.
Chuck Carroll and I were joking at the beginning there about no politics during the holidays, no politics conversations. But yeah. Politics have gotten so divisive in this country. Yeah. And I wonder how that affects conversation. Is it best to just not go near it, or is there a way to actually talk politics without sort of wanting to wring the other person's neck by the end of it?
Right. Yeah. I think we've gotten to a point where I might have had a different answer 6 or 8 years ago than I have now. Right now, I think we've gotten to a point where we're so off the mark as far as being able to listen and hear one another that we can't just jump into a political conversation and start, touting our position or, pushing our position. I think the fundamental problem is that if you're in a conversation that sort of doesn't feel right,
right,
the best thing you can do is just to stop talking about what your perspective is and step back and say, are there a few facts we could agree on? Because fundamentally, yeah, we have lost that art of saying, wait a minute, what do we know and what don't we know? And if we can't agree on that foundation of facts, you're not going to get anywhere in a conversation. And in fact, I've walked away from multiple conversations and multiple group dialogues,
right,
where I couldn't get the group or the people to just settle down on some fundamental facts.
I was talking to my sister about this in terms of social, like, don't get angry and start like kind of being nasty in terms of someone's view. Just put out some facts and say, and kind of respond in that way. Chuck, this was fun. Hope you can come back real soon. Chuck Wisner, he is leadership advisor and author. His book, The Art of Conscious Conversations, Transforming How We Talk, Listen, and Interact.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive, stay in crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
And we have just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up what will be a busy week, certainly a chock full of economic data. We'll hear from Jay Powell. We talked about this. We're already hearing from members of the Fed today. But let's get to it with Anne Mulledy. So great to have her back in our studio, head of active equity at Allspring Global Investments. She joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Welcome back.
Thanks, Carol.
It feels good. Feels more normal.
It does. Great to be back.
Anything normal about this market environment, or how do you assess it?
Well, it's getting more and more normal every day.
Why do you say that?
Because the volatility, even though, like, I think, a lot of us look at the VIX and say, oh, that is volatility. I think investors in the market think, gosh, you never know from where the market starts in the morning to where it ends, what's really going to happen. I think we've had more 1% moves than we've seen since the Great Recession this year. And that's a lot for everyday investors to handle.
Well, so what are the conversations with clients like in an environment like that? And are people, you know, doing the right thing and getting greedy when others are fearful, or are they fearful like everybody else?
Well, I think, you know, it's really challenging to get people who even who are in the business, professional investors, to take emotion out of the decision making and to really think long term when there's news flow every day, when things change all of the time. And so a lot of our conversations with clients are just about, you know, staying diversified, thinking about long term, and looking at this volatility as opportunity and not just as a tough time, but, you know, what opportunity does it present for the next, you know, several years potentially.
Is it problematic, Anne, if you think about Jim Bullard coming out from the St. Louis Fed and talking about, you know, maybe a higher rate environment, not only next year, but into 2024? Is that problematic, I mean, for equity valuations to still have to maybe come down even further, or just asset classes in general?
You know, it's a great question, Carol, and it's one that we've had to wrestle with for the last, you know, more than 12 months.
Yeah.
The good news, I think, if there is a good side to this, is that the market, the multiple compression has happened. A lot of it has been in it. You know, the market's down more than 20%. That's all multiple compression. Earnings are still going to be positive for the year.
Right.
And a lot, consensus is still positive for next. I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah.
But that expectation has really, really been lowered. We're starting to see earnings also kind of come in a bit. I think we're going to see more of that. And so when you're an investor, not a trader, you go, okay, the future is different. And, you know, the cost of capital is more expensive. You have to build that into your modeling and into your fundamentals. And if you're running a company, mm-hmm. you have to run your company a little bit differently than you have in the last decade.
Is the risk appetite just not there, do you think, among the CEOs, the CFOs, to sort of, you know, invest in their companies, to boost their buybacks, boost their dividends? Is that part of the issue, do you think?
I do think they're human, just like us, right? Mm-hmm. And they're captured by emotion and the unknown. And when you listen to the Fed officials, you know, threaten of much higher rates, they are probably pausing. I think what our investment teams are really trying to stay focused on are what companies have the strength to weather however long the storm is going to be, right? And if it's just a shallow recession and short-lived, great. But what if it's longer? What if it's deeper? And I think management's good CEOs, CFOs think through those scenarios as well. And if you look at balance sheets and free cash flow, those are metrics that allow you to have flexibility as a company for a long period of time and gain competitive ground even in downturns. And those are the types of companies our investment teams are really focused on right now.
And do you model for maybe a recession, whether it's shallow or a little bit deeper, but a recession where people are working?
You know, it's so interesting, right? Because it's
just crazy.
The million-dollar
like.
Question. It
right.
is. Look, I do think we're going to see some weakness in the labor market. It's not showing up as quickly as some would expect, but we all know it's a lagging indicator.
Yeah.
We're seeing job freezes. We have seen layoffs in some of the tech companies. I think you're going to start to see it in some financial companies as well, mm-hmm. likely as we head into the new year. It's going to show up in other places as well. It may not be unemployment levels that we've seen historically, and there's other reasons for it too, right? Just demographic reasons why we might not hit those low levels. So I think, you know, never say never, never say the future looks different than the past, but there's a good possibility this one won't look exactly like they have in the past.
It could be different.
It could
this
be different.
Time around.
Yep.
Yeah, well, I wonder, you know, you sort of get the impression that with this huge rally we've seen in equities since the middle of October, that people are kind of, you know, hoping or betting that the worst is over with inflation, with the Fed rate hikes. You know, we have seen inflation, it's still hot, but it's come down. Yeah. Interest rates have kind of leveled off. Yeah. Is that wishful thinking, do you think?
I think, you know, a little bit. There's been a lot of money on the sidelines waiting to get in, and I think people are worried about missing it. I do think there's going to be
a FOMO.
Yes, exactly. I do think there's going to be a little more downside risk here, right? We're not, again, earnings expectations have just started to come in a little bit this past quarter. I think we need to see more of that happen before we officially hit the bottom. And I also think investors cannot expect a V-shaped recovery brought on by policy or the Fed. And yeah, we've had that in the past. That's right. What's caused these huge inflections. I don't think we're going to get that.
So where would you commit new money at this point? You talk about the importance of free cash flow, mm-hmm, key metric to watch. So, and where would you put new money?
Yeah,
new investments?
It's really hard to pick a sector. I would say, you know, if you want a sector, healthcare is a good one because there's still innovation, there's still growth, there's still the possibility for dividends, and we know in recessionary time periods, healthcare has been an area that's had the least amount of EPS, of earnings pullback. Yeah. And in fact, it's been positive most of the time. Outside of that, there are a lot of attractive names in all kinds of other industries. And I think when we get too general about saying move away from tech or move away from industrials, we're painting things with a broad brush, right, when there are unique opportunities in all sectors right
so
now.
So be a stock picker.
Then be a stock picker. Exactly. Like. Exactly.
Well, and I know you're a stock picker and preach the gospel of stock picking, but at some point you got to say these bond yields look attractive too.
They are. And you know, you got me there. it's one of those unique times where, you know, look, you've had bonds and equities go up. They're not supposed to be so correlated. You also had them painfully go down together. And I do think that the bond market is, you know, showing some really attractive areas for investors right now, too. So, again, there's a lot to be fearful of, but there's a lot of opportunity out there.
Like the optimism that's out there. Anne Mulatti, who brought us that optimism, head of active equity over at Allspring Global Investments. Thank you so much.
You.
Happy holidays. Hope we see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us live on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take. Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.